Well, we invite all of our parents with children to make their way down to the special kids room that's going on today. This would be appropriate for any child that is probably under the age of 13. So the age of understanding to 13 would be a good age to send down the hall. Because we're going to be talking about some interesting things tonight. And they're sexual things, and while they're appropriate for us to talk about as adults, we believe that it's probably best that we allow you as parents to deal with that with your own children at the appropriate time. And so we invite you to make use of that down the hallway, which is a little bit different than what we do here typically. Typically, we want to have our children involved in everything that we do, including the message time. We'll get back to that in, I believe, next week. We're going to get back to that. So tonight, we've got a message. The message is called Sexual Healing, Doubts, Difficulties, and Dysfunctions. And we've been working through the Song of Solomon, which is a book that rarely gets preached on in the church. And it's a real shame that it isn't preached on more. I hope that you're in the same boat that I am. I've thoroughly enjoyed the messages that have gone previous to tonight. Jason's done a great job over the past couple weeks with that. And I've just been blessed either by listening to them or by preparing them. And sometimes we as pastors feel a little guilty because we get all the blessing of putting all this stuff together and we have to read all the books and do all the research. And to do that, it's a wonderful blessing on our side because we reap the benefits of that. And we hope that it comes across in the message that we bring. But understand that there are other things and other resources that we are going to recommend and turn your attention to that would be wonderful for your own marriage. And so tonight, again, we're going to be in the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. We're going to be in chapter 5. If you're not sure where that is, basically, if you find Psalms in your book, which is about a third to halfway through your book, you'll find this large section called Psalms. And then keep turning to the right. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and then the Song of Solomon. Rather short book. It's 8 chapters long. But as we've learned over the last couple of weeks, this is Hebraic Middle Eastern literature. And so it's nonlinear, which is very hard for our Western minds to wrap itself around. But we invite you to kind of go on this journey with us, and we'll try to make it as linear as possible, but understand that it is not linear literature. It uses something called chiastic structure, which means it's very cool. Tonight we're going to be looking at a section of Scripture that actually corresponds with a section of Scripture that I preached on 3 weeks ago. So what was in the beginning is now coming full circle, and you'll hear it again at the end. And so it's more of a thought rhyme than it is word rhyme. And there's large chiastic structure, and there's also smaller. Last week, Jason brought a message from the climax of the Song of Solomon, and that's the marriage night. I invite you to check that out on our website if you haven't heard that. It's a wonderful message. And before that, it was all the events that were leading up to this climax, this middle point, the top of the chiastic pyramid. And so we have come to this point now, and we've looked at what it takes to get to the point of marriage. And basically what we're going to look at over the next 2 weeks, today and next week, is what does it take to make a marriage succeed? Or a lifelong relationship. What does that take to succeed? And particularly tonight, we're going to focus on sexual dysfunction and sexual healing. And we believe that it's very appropriate to talk about this because one research study showed, over 50% of all couples will experience some sort of sexual dysfunction sometime in their relationship. So we believe it's very appropriate to bring tonight. If you are in a committed lifelong relationship, most likely you will either, or maybe you have experienced this. If you haven't, fantastic. Congratulations. It is possible that sometime future that you may, or you may just go through your entire committed life with no sexual dysfunction. In that case, congratulations. It's wonderful. But for those people here gathered tonight that have experienced this or may experience this, we hope this message brings some healing and some help. So the structure tonight is kind of like a mini structure of the overall. And it's going to start at the very beginning with hurt. And then there's going to be a section where Shulamite gives tenfold praise. And then there's going to be a garden scene. And then there's going to be the forgiveness. And then there's going to be a reminder of the garden scene. And then Solomon is going to give a tenfold praise. And then there's going to be healing. And so we have that chiastic structure again, even within the smaller section that we're going to look at tonight. And so, again, we hope that tonight will be a blessing because we realize that as a whole, we receive a very mixed message about sex, about sexuality, even and especially from the church. There's an author, Doug Huck, and he says it this way. He says, since Adam and Eve first knew that they were naked, humans have been embarrassed and have tried to get rid of their sexuality. Children sneak into the barn and or the bushes to play doctor. And after adolescents learn about sex from their friends, parents embarrassingly try to explain it. And often leaving the impression that it's something dirty you do with the one you love, which is a crazy thought to try to hold in your head together. We get the message that sex is bad, the feeling sexual is worse, and we say that sex is a gift from God. But our attitude says that it's the ultimate curse. So here's the tension. We get one side saying sex is wonderful, it's God-given, it's God-created. And then we get a lot of influence from either society or a lot of times from the church saying it's bad, don't do it, unless you're married, and then it's fine. And so there's a great deal of tension there. I want to make a special note to singles or divorcees or widows or widowers. This book, this section that we're talking about tonight, is definitely about the marriage relationship between Solomon and his bride, the Shulamite. I believe that if you're not currently married, many of you will be married someday, so hopefully you'll take this into your marriage. For those of you that may remain single, or you're just in a season of singleness right now in your life, I believe there are truths that we'll talk about tonight that you can apply to relationships in general. There are definitely things that are very specifically sexual, but there are things that I think you can apply generally also. So hopefully there will be something that everyone will take away from this tonight. I believe there will. So the first stage, the thing that we want to start off with is in understanding sexual feeling and sexual dysfunction is we believe there are five stages that we'll talk about tonight. And the first one is that the stage one, mutual hurt. Mutual hurt. And we say it that way, that there's mutual hurt, because a lot of times if in a relationship a person has been hurt and another person knows that they have hurt someone else, a lot of times it's very easy for reconciliation to happen. But what happens when both people feel hurt and both people feel that they're in the right and the other person needs to ask for forgiveness? And so that's what we're dealing with here tonight. And we're going to pick it up in chapter 5 of the Song of Songs. And Jason ended with verse 1 of chapter 5 last week. We're going to pick it up with verse 2. And there are three major characters as we read through this. There's the Shulamite, which is the woman in this reading. There's Solomon, who is the husband. And then there is this chorus of young maidens that show up once in a while. And you'll see them as they come into the story. So we're going to start with the Shulamite in verse 2. They've just had their wedding night. And there's this tremendous jump from verse 1 to verse 2. Now it's later on in their marriage. And the Shulamite says this. She says, I slept, but my heart was awake. In other words, she's dreaming. She's in a restless sleep. And whether we're not really sure if what the follows here is actually happening or this is a dream that she's having. So it may be dream state. It may be actually happening. She's kind of in and out of sleep or something like that. But she says, listen. My beloved is knocking. And this is what her beloved says to her. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with drops of the night. I had put off my garment. Oh, I'm sorry. Then the Shulamite picks up with her response to him in verse 3 and says, I had put off my garment. How could I put it on again? I have bathed my feet. How can I soil them? In other words, what she's saying is she's kind of throwing out excuses as to why she's not going to get up. And she even throws in the religious card there, because to soil her feet would be to kind of become unclean, and she would have to go through the ritual of cleaning again before she got back into bed. So she kind of throws out the religious card and says, no, it's against my religion to open the door for you. And so she throws out her excuses. And then verse 4, it says, my beloved thrust his hand into the opening, or a better way to translate that is from the opening. To lead, and it's possible that what he's doing there is leaving a reminder to her of his presence. We'll see that. We'll pick that up in a couple of verses. But he thrusts his hand through, and her innermost being, my innermost being, she says, yearned for him. So the problem, the mutual hurt that's going on here, is that sex or physical intimacy, closeness, is being used as punishment and reward. And sex is never intended, it was never intended to be used as a punishment or as a reward. There's a story of a woman who was seeking marital counseling, and she went into her counselor and was explaining what was going on in their relationship, and she was very upset because her husband was, in her mind, oversexed. He was just always has a ravenous sexual appetite. And she said to her counselor that she was just so upset, and he would have sex twice a month if she would let him. Should be funnier. Twice a month, you see, it was very infrequently. Never mind. So she was thinking that that twice or once a month was good, and he was thinking that that was not enough. She was withholding sex, and here it's the same problem in the Song of Songs that the Shulamite is withholding sex. And we have a lot of scripture to cover today, but I want to go into another section of scripture just briefly, because I really believe it talks to this whole what are husband and wife's responsibility to each other within the sexual relationship, within the marital relationship. So let's flip over, if you have your Bibles, to the New Testament. It's going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. It's after the Gospels, after Paul's letter to the Romans. It should hit 1 Corinthians right there. If you don't have your Bibles, it'll be on the screen here too. So 1 Corinthians chapter 7, starting right in verse 1, says this. This is Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Now concerning the matters about which I wrote. So right here from the beginning, we can see that the Corinthians wrote a letter to Paul saying, or asking the question, well, what about sex? What does Christianity have to say about sex? Because understand, in the Greek mindset, they were going through this dualism of body and spirit. And according to that dualism, everything that was spirit was good, and everything that was body or flesh was bad. So accordingly, sex was bad. So the Corinthians asked Paul, what about sex? Is it good? Is it bad? It seems to feel good. How can something that feels so good be so bad? You know, it's basically what they're saying to him. And Paul responds to them with this letter. And so he says, it is well for a man not to touch a woman. He's talking about celibacy there. But because of cases of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Interesting. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And so what Paul is saying here, this is an interesting phrase in the Greek, and we really don't have a direct translation into English, but it's not saying that the wife has absolutely no right over her body. What it's saying here is that while the wife has a right over her body, the husband's right for that body to receive pleasure from his wife is a higher priority. And the inverse is true also. While the husband has a right to his body, the wife's right to receive pleasure from the husband's body is a higher priority. And so the priority is always that the one spouse is pleasing, is giving to the other spouse. And so there's this kind of trying to outdo each other with the blessing of each other physically. Paul says in verse 5, do not deprive one another except, and here he gives some outlines for it, except perhaps by agreement for a set time. And he says set time, it's a very distinctive time, the time that you have set down with your calendar and said, okay, from this date to this date, we are not going to experience sexual relations with each other. Why? Paul goes on and he says, to devote yourselves to prayer, That's the way the NRSV translates it. If you have your Bibles there, some of them might translate it to prayer and fasting, which is an excellent translation of the Greek there. Definitely those two words are in the original language. So prayer and fasting. So you're going to set this time aside for prayer and fasting, and then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. This I say by way of concession, not of command. And this is what he's saying. I wish that all of you were as myself, or as I myself am. In other words, I wish that you all were celibate. But each, and this is a very big but. Anytime there's a but in the Bible, you've got to pay very close attention. But each has a particular gift from God. One having one kind and another a different kind. Paul is saying that celibacy is not just something you can, you know, screw down the screws and say, I'm not going to have sex anymore. Celibacy is a gift. It is a God-given gift, the same as all the other gifts in 1 Corinthians 12 that are laid out, or various Romans 12 or Ephesians 4 or 1 Peter 4. Those gifts, celibacy is another gift. It's not something that was intended for everyone. It is a God-given gift that He will empower in your own life. So you might ask, how often is it okay then? How often is sex okay? And just to let you know, some studies have been done about how frequently men and women would like to enjoy sexual relations in their lives. Men, on average, said that they would like to enjoy sex, on average, 3.2 times a week. Women, on average, said 2.8 times a week. So that's good to know. It kind of shows that the average is almost the same. And this idea that men are oversexed sexual lunatics, that that's all they think about, well, that might be true. But at least the act itself, or the desire to act out on those thoughts, three times a week. And women are right there, right equal with that. And so it's something that God has created in us. He's given us these desires in our lives. And within a committed, lifelong, mutually monogamous relationship, not much is off limits. Again, I invite you, if you didn't hear last week's sermon where Jason specifically talked about that, I invite you to go to our website, go to artisanchurch.com/podcast and download the podcast of that, or just download the message itself and hear what Jason had to say about that from the pinnacle of this message from the Song of Songs last week. But whatever is done, as we are reading here in 1 Corinthians, it's done with love. It's always with the partner's best interests in mind. And so that brings us to the second stage of this five stages of sexual healing, of dysfunction and healing. Stage two is where the Shulamith has a change of heart. So change of heart, stage two. We'll pick it up in verse 5 of chapter 5. The Shulamith says this, I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh, upon the handles of the bolt. And remember how it said that he had thrust his hands into the door? Well, one idea, or one way to translate that, is that the idea that he left a reminder of his presence there for her. He's kind of left a perfumed note, shall we say, on the door handle. These are the spices and the perfumes that they enjoy in their lovemaking. And so he's left that scent on the door handle. Another way to think about this is that, or another translation, is that she is actually talking about having stimulated herself, or self-stimulation. And there's a lot of question, a lot of debate. Is self-stimulation, is masturbation right or wrong? Does the Bible say it's right? Does the Bible say it's wrong? And we're not going to get into that tonight. I'm sorry. But if you would really like to have a heated debate and discussion about that, we would come to Pastors and Pints on second Wednesday of the month. We can talk about that at Pastors and Pints. Or another fantastic book, I invite you to look up the authors Penner and Penner. They're a husband-wife Christian counseling couple that do sexual counseling. And they have a fantastic book. They have several fantastic books, but one of them is called The Gift of Sex. And they do an excellent job of tackling this whole area of self-pleasuring or masturbation, whether it's right or wrong. Tonight, no, too much to get into. So Let's get back into the change of heart that Shulamith is having here. Verse 6 says, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and was gone. My soul failed me, or it went out to him, or it left her weak. When he spoke, I sought him, but I did not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. And here, as we go on in verse 7, this is another reason why it's very probable that she's still in this dreamlike state. Because, as it says in verse 7, making the rounds in the city, the sentinels found me. They beat me, they wounded me, they took away my mantle, those sentinels of the walls. And as you can probably imagine, this is the queen, King Solomon's wife. If sentinels were to lay a hand on the queen, their time on this earth would be very short. So most likely, this is not really happening. This is most likely a dream that is going on here. And so the sentinels in the dream represent those in authority, those that are supposed to protect the city. And most likely, this is kind of a, you know, I don't mean to go all Freudian on you here, but most likely this is an image of God in her dream. And she's feeling guilty. She's feeling that she needs to be punished. She needs to be beaten and her mantle taken away from her. She feels that without that she can't have any kind of reconciliation. So here, guilt is kind of playing a good role. It's kind of turning her thoughts, turning her heart to an area of forgiveness. And, she feels that she has been harmed in this relationship. She feels that, she's prepared, gotten ready, waited for Solomon, and Solomon never shows up. He's away on the affairs of state. He feels wronged in some ways because he has been away. He's wet, he's drenched, he's cold. All he wants to do is come home and snuggle with his wife. And she says, go away. I don't want a thing to do with you. Because she's upset that he's been away for so long. And so they both feel wronged. And here you see that her heart is turning and saying, I feel guilty for turning him away. And so in verse 8 she says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I am faint with love. And again, this is identical to chapter 2, verse 5, that the peak of the longing during the courtship period. So here at the end is where it's reflecting back and it's mirroring or echoing the thought that it was early on in chapter 2. So guilt can be a positive thing in some senses, but in most of the time in a relationship, guilt is one of those things that inhibits good sex. You know, guilt is something that was instilled upon us as we were kids. You know, maybe they were caught playing doctor and the mom or the dad tells them, that's bad, that's dirty, you don't touch people there. That's their woo-woo or their hoo-hoo or whatever it is that we use as parents so we don't use the real terms. And so you're not supposed to talk about it. You're not supposed to name the body parts. You're not supposed to touch each other. You're not supposed to enjoy those feelings that feel good. And so there's great guilt, and we bring that guilt into the sex relationship with us, into the marriage bed with us. Another thing that we can bring in with us is anger. And a lot of times that can come also from our upbringing as children and where we're told as kids that we're never good enough, that we always have to be striving for that next level, that we don't meet the expectations. And we can bring that into the bedroom with us. And so that can cause terrible fear and terrible dysfunction, especially for men, but also for women, resulting in things like erectile dysfunction and other things. So anger could be a second one. But a third one is lack of self-worth. That idea of self-worth where we can actually sabotage our own relationship and that we're not worthy of feeling these feelings. We're not worthy of being praised, of being looked at by our spouse in a loving way. And so we actually sabotage our own relationship by pulling a Peg Bundy and sitting on the couch and eating bonbons all day or going the other extreme and getting into some other eating disorder where we become emaciated. So we've got this low self-worth that has impacted us, and we've brought that into our marriage. All of these kind of go to the bottom line, the baseline of anxiety and fear. And anxiety and fear is a marriage destroyer. It's a sexual arousal destroyer. And so we're pointing out that these are sexual dysfunctions, but the good news is that there's healing and there's hope. And I think a lot of what Song of Songs is telling us here is how we can find that hope. And so let's keep going. Let's pick it up in verse 9 of chapter 5. And the young maidens, they say to the Shulamites, "What is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women? What's so special about him? What is your beloved more than any other beloved or another beloved that you thus adjure us or you make this command of us? What is so special about him?" And she goes on and proceeds to tell him, and this is the tenfold praise of Solomon given by the Shulamite. Verse 10, it says, "My beloved is all radiant and ruddy. He's glows. He's got a healthy glow about him. He's distinguished among 10,000. He stands out in the crowd. His head is the finest gold, or he's crowned with purity. His locks are wavy, black as a raven," meaning he's youthful. "His eyes are like doves beside springs of water, bathed in milk and fitly set." I want to talk a little bit about that. Fitly set, or set like jewels. "His eyes are focused on his wife and his wife alone." And I think that's a very important thing for us to realize and talk about. I was over at a friend's house not more than a couple weeks ago, and the television was on, and we were just chatting, and it was my friend and his wife standing next to him. And on the TV, somebody came up on the TV, it was some singer or something like that, and he said, "Wow, she's hot." Guys, if you're not married, or even if you are married, I'm giving you a little advice. If you're not married, don't ever do this. And if you are married, please don't ever say this in front of your wife. Make reference to another woman and say, "She's hot." Because basically what you've just done is you said, "Honey, that is what I desire. That hot woman on the television, that hot woman on the magazine cover, that hot woman on the internet, that's the bar. And you need to meet that. And that is unfair, unkind, and unloving to ever set that bar." Dr. Ursula Uffman, she's a sex therapist in New York, says it this way. She's referring to any kind of image that stimulates a person. And that's basically defined as pornography. And she says this, "Pornography is so accessible. And now with things like streaming video and webcams, guys are getting sucked into a compulsive behavior," she says. "What's most regrettable is that it can really affect relationships with women. I've seen some young men lately who cannot get aroused with a woman, but have no problem interacting with the internet. Live thing, problems. Virtual images, no problems." Very interesting paradigm that seems to be setting itself up here. I think a big danger is that young men who are constantly exposed to these fake, always willing women, and I might add in there with no commitment, start to have unreal expectations from real women, which makes them phobic about relationships. Very interesting quote. It talks about how pornography, or just images in general, setting that desire or the image of our desire on something other than our spouse, other than the person that we've committed our life to, can be a very dangerous thing. And I want to show one clip from a video called Pure Life of a guy that really sensed the effects of pornography in his life.
I would have to say that pornography is very deceptive, like sin is in general. And it reaches sometimes to what we think is a great need for us. But it's deceptive and it is very devastating. I still have images today of the very first book I ever looked at that had pornography in it. Those images will probably never leave my mind. And it is definitely something that's progressive. To start with, it just gets you started in realizing that there is a way to satisfy your own flesh in a somewhat secretive manner. But before you know it, you're craving it over and over again because it doesn't require anything of you as a partner would, or as a real intimate relationship with another person would. So it just drains everything that you have. It's like any other addiction. You go after it and you're consumed by it before you know it. And by then it's too late to really be able to pull away from it. Devastated a good portion of my life, and it certainly is not worth any of the seeming promises that it gives by its attraction.
I'd just like to let you know, if you're out there and you're a person that searches for porn over the internet, or you're having...
Well, there's actually, you saw a little bit of a second clip. There's actually three clips on there, and the second guy that you saw, one of the comments that he makes that I thought was really impactful was, he said, take your life and think about the level of sexual activity that you would never go beyond. Think of sexual acts that you would never do, and kind of draw that line in the sand and say, you know, I'll never accept money for sex, or I'll never sleep with anybody outside of my marriage, or I'll never have a same-sex relationship, or I'll never, whatever it happens to be, have unprotected sex, or whatever it is. He says, draw that line in the sand and realize that with sexual addiction, with pornography, it is increasingly addictive and destructive. And whatever that line is, you will cross it. Because just like any other drug, any other thing that you get addicted to, eventually you become numb to it. And you have to up the ante. You have to go to the next level, the next thing, whatever that is, to get your high, to get your fix. So pornography is very much, and addiction to pornography is very much like addiction to any drug. In fact, I've heard different studies that say that it's more addictive than heroin. Very dangerous. Some facts about pornography. It is a $12 billion business here in the United States. $57 billion worldwide. It dwarfs the combined revenue of ABC, NBC, and CBS. $6.2 billion is what those three bring in together. Porn is $12 billion. It's greater than the revenue of football, baseball, and basketball combined. And you know how much they make. Two-thirds of porn viewers are men and one-third of women. But an interesting statistic about that, while more men view pornography, women are more likely to act out in real life the fantasy that they see in pornography. So men view, women do, if you want to think of it that way. 10% of Americans are sexually addicted. That is 27 million people. 27 million people are addicted to sex and pornography. 20% of men and 13% of women view porn at work. So if you're an employer, this isn't just something that you need to deal with personally. It's something that you need to deal with your employees, and it will affect your employees' activities. And sexual addiction is defined as a persistent and escalating pattern or patterns of sexual behaviors acted out despite increasingly negative consequences to self or others. And so we want to just take a moment here in our message and as we're talking about sexual dysfunction and say if you are a man or a woman that is caught in sexual addiction, you need help and you need to get out because it's just a downward spiral and you will wind up in places you never thought possible. And we want to be a help. We want to be a service to you. If you're a woman and you need to talk to a woman, you don't feel comfortable talking to one of the guys on staff here, we invite you to talk to our wives. We also want to make available to you on our website. Most likely it'll be posted on Monday or Tuesday. There'll be links along with the message that will direct you to sites. If you're not sure, you think maybe you might have a problem with pornography, we'll have a link there with a website that you can actually take a little quiz, a little test, and see if you are addicted potentially to pornography. We invite you to use those. There will be resources out there on the web also that we will direct you to that will help put blockers in place, put accountability in place, so that you can end this very destructive cycle. Very important, very destructive downward spiral that we want to see people get out of. And so, by the way, that information, that video, and a lot of other great information is found on a website called XXXChurch.com. It's the best Christian porn site out there. It's their little tagline. And XXXChurch.com, it's XXXChurch.com. Fantastic website. We invite you to go out there and check it out. It has great stuff for guys like Save the Kittens and great stuff for girls like the No Hope Pledge. And so it's got stuff for everybody. And you'll just have to go out to check that out to see what those things are. So his eyes, though, Solomon's eyes, are fitly set. His eyes are directed toward his wife. And he says, "This, you are the thing that I compare everyone else to." Remember earlier in the Song of Songs, he talks about how she is a lily among the brambles. She says that she's just a common field flower. And he said, well, if you're just a common field flower, then all the other field flowers are just thickets and thorns. You are a beautiful flower. And that is what he sets his eyes on. And she keeps going. Verse 13, she says this. She says, "His cheeks are like beds of spices, yielding fragrance. His lips are lilies, distilling liquid myrrh. His arms are rounded gold, set with jewels. His body is ivory work, encrusted with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns, set upon bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon." It reminds her of home. Brings her comfort. "Choice as the cedars. His speech is most sweet. And he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved. And this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem." So she kind of makes her case. And again, this is a beautiful example of the Shulamite seeing that she has a sexual dysfunction, seeing that there's a problem in the relationship, she asks for help. And it's a very difficult thing. I know, I understand. I know that these are things that are embarrassing to talk about. But what we're encouraging you to do is take that risk. If you are encountering some kind of sexual dysfunction or sexual hurt in some way, take the example of the Shulamite and talk to people about that. Ask for help. So the stage three is the Shulamite is now ready to make amends. And the young maidens come to the Shulamite and are ready to help her with her amends. And this is chapter 6, verse 1. It says, "Where has your beloved gone, O fairest among women? Which way has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you?" So they're going to help. She's asked for help, and they're going to come help her. The Shulamite says, "My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to pasture his flock in the gardens, and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved's is mine. He pastures his flock among the lilies." She knows her husband. She knows what his routine is. So when they ask, well, where is he? She can now say, well, he's probably doing what he usually does with the affairs of state or taking care of business as he needs to. And so she knows exactly where he is. And she goes and she is ready to make amends. And one thing that I think we can all learn about here in this chapter is that she goes to ask forgiveness. She goes to make things right. And she goes without any kind of expectation of what his response will be. And that's very important when we make amends. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they have a step 8, which talks about making amends. And it says this, it says, we make a list of all the persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And that desire is to be that we become willing to make amends. We become willing to say, you know what, I screwed up. I'm sorry. I would like to make this right. And it doesn't say anything about what the other person has to do in response. We just need to be willing to do that. What the other person does, whether they accept that amends or whether they reject it, whether they say, take a leap, or whether they give you a big hug, that is completely up to them. Our responsibility is to be ready to make those amends. And so she does. She goes to find her husband. And that brings us to the fourth step, which is preemptive forgiveness. And before she can say anything, Solomon in chapter 6, verse 4 says this. He says, you are beautiful as tears of my love, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me or they arouse me. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. They're bright, they're white. All of them bear twins, not one among them is bereaved. Your cheeks are like halves of pomegranates behind your veil. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and maidens without number. So he's saying that all these women I could have. This idea of the 60 queens and 80 concubines most likely is referring to the fact that David, his father, has passed on as his collateral or as his inheritance to his son, his concubines and his wives. And so he said he's surrounded by all these women. But, verse 9, my dove, my perfect one, is the only one. The darling of her mother, flawless to her that bore her. The maidens saw her and called her happy. The queens and concubines also, they praised her. So she is the only one in his eyes. And she has such a great reputation, and she's such a wonderful person, that even her competition, the other queens, the other concubines, praise her, call her happy. And the young maidens ask a question, saying, who is this that looks forth like the dawn, fair as the moon, bright as the sun, terrible as an army with banners? Who is this awesome vision that you're speaking of? And as we think about this preemptive forgiveness, one of the things that I think about is the love chapter. 1 Corinthians 13. If you're not familiar with it, is often referred to as the love chapter. And it's the chapter that says that love is patient, love is kind, and it goes on and lists all the attributes of love. Well, what I would like to throw out is that there's a very important verse in there that says that love keeps no record of wrongs. There was a woman that was in a ministry that I used to be a part of that was a very angry person. And according to this definition, not a very loving person, because she could tell you every single person, the date and the time, seriously, that they harmed her. She kept a list. But the thing about lists, especially this kind of list, is that it's only doing damage to the person that's holding onto the list. It's not hurting any of the people that are on the list. So, in our lives today, as we think about this message of sexual hurt and healing, or just hurt and healing in general, do you have a list? Are there people on your list that you need to move to a place of forgiveness? I'd like to invite you to let go of the list. Later on, we have an enacted prayer that Jason will lead us in that will have that physical act of letting go in different ways. And so we'll have that opportunity today. And I also want to point out that we realize that it's not by our own strength that we can do that. That it's by the strength that God gives us. It's by the strength of Christ. And as I mentioned, we're taking a very natural approach to this. You can interpret the Song of Solomon in a bunch of different ways. The allegorical or the typological or the dramatic reading of the Song of Songs. We're going at it very naturally, what it says it means, except for that it's poetic. But here, give me just a little bit of grace as I allegorize just a little bit and offer maybe some hope here. 1 John 4, write this down if you want to check this out later on. I invite you to check it out. 1 John chapter 4, verses 8 and 16 say very specifically that God is love. So you can take 1 Corinthians 13 and every place it says love is patient, love is kind, you can stick God's name in there. And so that also means that God keeps no record of wrongs. And what I would like to suggest is that your list, some of us think that God is up there in heaven like Santa Claus, making a list of who's naughty and who's nice, right? Keeping a list of our rights and our wrongs. That list of your wrongs was wiped out with Christ and His sacrifice on the cross. When Christ spoke His very last word from the cross, He used the word tetelestai in Greek, which means it is finished or paid in full. The price that was required of all of us was paid by Jesus. And at that point, when He died, our list was wiped out. So your list of wrongdoings is erased. And just like here in the Song of Solomon, when you turn to God, it's just like the Shulamith coming to her bride, her husband, who's waiting with open arms. She doesn't even have the opportunity to say a word, and He embraces her and says, "You're beautiful." And He doesn't even remember what the offense was against Him. And so that moves us to our fifth stage, our final stage, and that's mutual healing. We're going to pick it up in chapter 6, verse 11. And the Shulamite says this. She says, "I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom." So she's saying, I went down to the place where my husband was to see if maybe there was some forgiveness there. Maybe forgiveness had blossomed or bloomed. Before I was aware, before I could say anything, before I could do anything, my fancy, or my soul, my desire, the one that I desire, set me in a chariot beside my prince. Another way to translate it is, her husband set her in a chariot of the prince of my people. He put her in a place of honor. He put her in a place that says, you're still my bride. You're still the one I love. You're still the one that I want to spend the rest of my life with. The young maidens respond, "Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return that we may look on you, look upon you." And Solomon says, he kind of whisks her away and says, "Why should you look, or how you would gaze in awe upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies," making reference to Jacob and Esau when they were coming together and they had a tension, they had a problem between the two of them. And there was great potential for a war to break out between Jacob and Esau and all the army that were following them. But instead, Esau forgave his brother. And there was a great celebration and a great healing that went on. How you would like to look upon those as a dance before two armies. How graceful are your feet in sandals. He turns his attention to his queen as he's whisking her away, going to a place of solitude, going out to a place where they can heal the hurt and have this mutual healing. Quite literally, this is the best part of fighting, is making up. And so he says to his wife, starting with her feet and going upward, "How graceful are your feet in sandals, O queenly maiden. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks for mixed wine. Navel is a misuse of the word. It's not navel. He's speaking of her genitals. You get the idea. This rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes pools in Heshbon by the gate of Beth Rabim. In other words, her eyes sparkle. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. It's majestic. It's not huge. It's majestic. Overlooking Damascus, your head crowns you like Carmel. Your beauty, this beautiful city of Carmel, is like your crown. Your beauty crowns you. And your flowing locks are like purple. That's a royal color. He's complimenting her, saying that you are queenly, that you are royal, and that the king is held captive in the tresses. Her beauty holds him captive. How fair and pleasant you are, O loved one, delectable maiden. You are stately as a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its branches. Have you ever heard the song "The Joker" by Steve Miller Band? You know, have this all rehearsed so I don't forget it during this sermon, and then I forget it. Thank you, John. Yes. Really love your peaches. Want to shake your tree? That's what's going on here. It's this practice of they wanted to make sure that their plants and their trees were fruitful, so they would take the male parts off of the male plants and they would cut them off and they'd bring them over to the female parts so that they were in close proximity so that there would definitely be pollination that would happen there. In other words, he's speaking about the birds and the bees. And he's saying, I want to make love to you. So I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its branches. Oh, may your breasts be like the clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your kisses like the best wine. So they're enraptured with each other. And she finishes this thought, she says, that goes down smoothly, gliding over the lips and teeth. And that's a terrible translation. It's glides over the lips and of the sleepers is another way to translate that word. So they make love after this terrible time of hurt, sexual dysfunction. There's a changing of heart. There's a forgiveness. There's a praising that goes on. They come together and they praise each other. He praises her. They make love to each other. And then they drift off to sleep in each other's arms. It's a beautiful picture of this hurt moving to healing. My wife and I, when we were preparing for our own marriage, we took dance lessons. We took it was great. We took everything from waltz to tango to foxtrot to jitterbug, swing dancing. And later we went on and we learned Lindy Hop, and it was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed dancing with each other. But early on, we experienced a lot of frustration. You know, I wanted to lead. She wanted to lead. I wanted to lead her this way. She didn't want to go that way. You know, I wasn't doing a very good job leading her, and she would go spin off in some other direction and start dancing with some other guy. You know, stuff like that. So early on, it was very frustrating. There was dysfunction there. There's a word in the Greek called perichoresis. It's a fantastic word. I invite you to write it down. It's phonetic. Go ahead and spell it however you want to. Perichoresis. But peri just means circle, and choresis is where we get our word choreography from. It means circle dance. And it describes the relationship of the Trinity. Father, Son, and Spirit dance together in this perichoresis. And you're really not sure who's leading, who's following, but you know when you watch people that know how to dance, it's beautiful. And that's the image of the Trinity. And we are created. Men and women are created in the image of God to be in relationship with that special person, to be in perichoresis, created as God in His image. And if you want to check that out, I invite you to turn to Genesis chapter 2 this week and read the creation story. All good relationships are going to have disagreements. It's part of being individuals coming together in a relationship. In fact, if you're in a relationship that isn't experiencing any kind of difficulty on occasion, most likely one of the two people has either just gone totally submissive and there are problems with that, or the other person has just gone totally dominant and is walking all over the other person. So in good relationships, there's going to be disagreements, there's going to be problems, there's going to be back and forth. But we are suggesting that a lifelong, committed, mutually monogamous relationship is that ballroom where the perichoresis can happen and can be perfected. We invite you to join the dance in your own lives in whatever way is appropriate. Amen.